river, and we don't know where that is. And so it leads us, lets us consider interesting things like the previous talk, or the stuff I was exploring yesterday in my floor plan. And so I think, you know, the sort of known ways of doing theoretical physics are here, and we kind of expect to land somewhere out here when we really understand it. But to motivate, so the only, to me, the only time I feel comfortable going way out in this space is when I know there's going to be some data to keep me honest at some point. So I feel, personally don't enjoy just theoretical leaps where there's absolutely no hope of being brought down to earth by data. And so in the case of dark energy, I think there's hope for tremendous improvement in our capacity, in the data that we have. And so one of the things I've been very active in is advocacy for these new experiments. And to do advocacy of new experiments, you need to do phenomenology. And phenomenology, I think, sort of by definition, involves occupying the space right around here in a pretty pedestrian way. And so what I'm going to talk about is very pedestrian sort of formulations of dark energy to help us model what experiments can do, and it's intentionally so. I think that's the language you have to speak. To go and tell someone to advocate for an experiment, I think going on about some theory that lives out here isn't going to help people really get the picture. So it's a very different flavor, intentionally so, than what I do when I try to hope to really understand dark energy. So the starting point for this talk is actually there was a dark energy task force. It was formed to contemplate future experiments. We created specific simulated data sets measuring different stages. Stage one was where we were at the time. Stage two was sort of in progress, medium term and long term larger experiments. And then we did that, and we created these sort of models of where we thought we could go, and we assessed the impact of those experiments, modeling dark energy in terms of an equation of state model that had two parameters and looked like this. So we basically asked, as we progress to better and better experiments, how well do we constrain these two parameters, as well as other cosmological, more standard cosmological parameters. And I'm going to phrase this talk in terms of follow-up questions. So if you have questions about the Dark Energy Task Force, the report's been out for a while, I'm happy to answer those outside of my talk, but I'm mainly going to focus on follow-up questions. And questions like these: in what ways might the choice of dark energy parameters bias the results we have? So that's an important question. One of the dynamics in this business is that there's people competing for what they hope will eventually be big bucks. They are very nervous when they think decisions are going to be made based on one thing or another that they perceive might be biased against their experiment. And there's a lot of anxiety. And so there's, I think, more focus on these questions. But my personal feeling is that there's actually more, people are much more anxious than is warranted by the facts on the ground. But that's often the case when the big bucks are involved, as we know in different forms. So we want to ask this question, and what we might result be biased based on different parameters. We want to ask the question, these are very abstract dark energy parameters. We don't know any actual dark energy models that have this form except for a cosmological constant. So there are specific dark energy models out there. None of them are that brilliant, but you should at least ask the question, what impact will these data sets have on specific dark energy models? And I address that in the context of scalar field models. To what extent can these data sets deliver discriminating power between, so can you discriminate, one thing is can you constrain parameters within a specific dark energy model? Can you discriminate between dark energy models? Then I'm going to comment briefly, if I may manage to leave time, about a new group that's sort of revisited some of these issues and it's almost done with our work. So, and if the chair could give me a 10-minute warning, that would be great. Okay. Just to give me, help me pace myself. And as most of you know, I love talks with lots of challenges and questions along the way, so keep at it, and I will monitor my progress accordingly. Kevin's various comments. One comment is, lots of people could come out and read papers, but there's various people that believe that the dark energy task force data models are too conservative in one respect or another, and they think we can actually do better than the dark energy task force did. And I've not incorporated those issues into this discussion, so that this is just a sort of a point of reference. I think it's good to explore all questions at once. And so the fixed point in this discussion is the dark energy task force model data sets, and I'm asking how the impact of those data sets look when you look at them from different languages, different points of view. So some people ask me, you worked so hard on the dark energy task force report, why don't you stick by it? Then the politically astute thing to do is to run around defending the parameters you chose like a good dogmatic person. And I just don't believe that's good. I think questioning is better than dogma. And I think it helps you. People can sniff out dogmatic thinking pretty easily. And plus the fact that scientific meetings don't usually work like this. You don't usually sit and embrace the word handed down from panels. And so I think, but in many ways, it turns out
that Lazarians do.
I think in many respects, the results in the parameters used by the task force is still pretty much intact. And I'll tell you which ways they are, which ways they're not. So I'm going to really rush through this. So I told you we constrained the task force constrained models, and we use figured merit in terms of area and the inverse area of the space and these parameters. We produced data sets, we produced comparisons, and bar charts, and technical points, and conclusions, and we can review that together as needed. But what I really want to do, and so I'll be talking about some of the task force results as we go on these comparisons, but I really want to go on these questions. So parameter choices. So how good is W0WA on ZOS? Here's some functions that come from this formula. It's in Z, so we know it's linear in A, if it's not linear. Here are some kinds of functional forms of W of Z that you might get from different dark energy models. They don't look very much alike. So what on earth are we doing using models that look like that? And before I launch into this, I'll say, by the way, but most of the modeling until that point had been done with a single parameter. So we were trying to be a little more adventurous, even back then, on the days of the dark energy task force. But now I want to talk about being more adventurous still. The first topic is work I did with Gary Bernstein to take the same model data sets, but model there's two. And the 9 appears because I chose 9 bins for a lot of these plots. The 9 turns out not to be a critical thing, but the fact that instead of a couple of parameters, we choose a piecewise constant model of WA, really with the interest of taking the limit as the bin gets small and allow a whole family of possible functions of WA. And we do it in a convenient way so we can measure relative change from a cosmological constant, which is an interesting way to have these conversations. So this is certainly not we're not the first people to do this. Lots of people have explored these ideas in the past. And one of the things, some of the things I like about this is that it allows much greater variety of W of A behavior. In a way, you can, as I'll show you, you can see, let each experiment sort of put its best foot forward. One experiment might measure some combination of these bins. Another experiment might measure another combination. And you can explore more fully whether each experiment gets a chance to show what it can do. And you can try to avoid some of the issues that if you're just looking at W0WA, some experiment might be nervous the competition is getting favored by that formulation. And Also, it is a language because we've chosen it this way, where any statistically significant signal in any of these bins, or any of the ways you can measure signal in delta W, is proof that it's not a cosmological constant. So it's very focused on the kinds of interesting questions you want to ask. This has a property which I've been calling convergence, and which I've recently learned in the technical world of statistics is called parameterization invariance, because as you increase the bin size, you expect you're zeroing in on a fixed function that's not going to change as you improve your parameterization. I really like that feature. I think parameterization independence is a kind of too pompous word for it, because you still have to think about whether you can parameterize W or other parameters. There's still some issues there. It's not as sort of universal sounding as the word, that technical word sounds, but these do have a very nice property. So you want to look at error ellipses and look at how well you constrain things. How do you talk about that in 9 or more dimensions? And well, it's not that hard, because an error ellipse in any number of dimensions is characterized by its principal axes and by its width in those directions. And so you can just analyze it in those terms. And it's sometimes called principal component analysis. And one of the nice features here is that you have a complete basis. You know, there are vectors in the discrete form, or there's a functional basis in the continuum limit that covers that you can expand any function of W of Z in the spaces. And the coefficients of these basis functions are the independently measured quantities. They're independent because these are orthogonal, uncorrelated directions of constraint. So it's a very convenient language. One thing I want to emphasize is that some people think that when you talk about these higher dimensional spaces, you wind up being very moving rapidly to the principal components, because you can't draw pictures in multi dimensions. But it's really important that, sort of on a point of comparison basis, what we're doing instead of W0, WA is WI. And that's the sort of side-by-side comparison of the translation. And the principal components is just a tool for analyzing it, just like we trivially just jumped right and looked at the ellipses in a two-parameter case. Principal components is just a crutch for analyzing higher dimensional matrices. And so, for example, the fact that from one experiment to another, the ellipses tend to rotate around in space, which is a rather interesting feature that helps us sort of triangulate in on better data. That fact is not a defect. It doesn't mean that you're using, that when you use this multi-parameter space, you're somehow presenting a moving target and choosing new parameters for each experiment. You're not doing that any more than you were for W0, WA. The independently measured combinations of parameters are changing from experiment to experiment, but the fundamental picture is not. And there's been recently some confusion expressed about that, so I'm trying to clarify that. Principal components is just a tool for analyzing any space you want. And it's particularly helpful, it's a helpful approach when you work in higher dimensions. So you can draw these things in this way. Here's a way of trying to put all this information on a page. These are the principal components. And you can think of them basically as modes of WC that are measured independently from one another. So if you, here in A, I put Z down here, the plots are in A. There's an interesting question that the convenient binning is actually constant in A, a technical point I can talk with you about later. There's a reason, there's some concrete reasons why you choose that. And then you say, what do you measure? Well, this is just stage 2. Let's look at better experiment stage 4. What do you measure? Well, the best measured mode is this blue one, very smooth mode measured. And here's the sigma, very small value of sigma. And the next best measured mode is this green one. And you see they increase with more oscillations as you go to higher, to more poorly measured modes. And I think there's a simple way to understand that. than doing your
time. So this is for a particular experiment.
Yeah, it is. But there's a general trend that the modes increase in oscillation. For example, here we're comparing two experiments, and you see one thing you can see immediately is that the second experiment is better, has a whole bunch of smaller signals. And then you can also see that the stage two experiment doesn't go to as high a redshift, so the well-measured modes just peter out at high redshift, whereas the better experiment has stuff going on at high redshift. So I find these are actually really, I can look at these for quite a while and learn, I'm interested in what I learn by looking at some of the details on a plot like this. For our purposes, here's the convergence. You can look at a finer grid and see that if you do fine enough grid, things converge pretty well. This is not a great plot for showing that. I'm going to go
around. So by intuitively, the most important nodes correspond to something happening at small redshifts.
No, the best nodes actually, well, there's a net. So I think here's, if I give you a whole barrel full of data and ask you to find the most well-constrained combination of that data, best you can do is add it all up, take the average, and then you're getting statistics all working in your favor. And that's what this mode does. It sort of, roughly speaking, adds everything up because it's positive everywhere. It doesn't oscillate. The next best thing you can do is divide it into two groups and subtract and get as much statistics as you can with two groups, and that's what this oscillating thing is doing. So that's the intuition I take from that. And you have to think a little more to ask why is it organized according to redshifts in such a simple way, because there's lots of different averages you can take, but not, we can talk about that too. So intuitively, the best measured mode is a broad mode. And then the more oscillations you look at, the harder it is to get good statistics, because you're differencing more things. So I'm going to report now. So these now I'm going to tell you what these bar charts are. They're basically saying how much does the area shrink in the strain area in the parameter space. How much does it shrink when you go to a better experiment? And as a reference point, we use stage two. We on this plot are the results we got from the task force using the two parameter space, and then perhaps not surprisingly, interestingly, you get much better constraints when you open up the larger parameter space, which is basically saying that the experiments do measure more than two parameters, and they're getting credit for it if you ask. So if you ask a more challenging question of these experiments, they give a better answer. It could be the other way. They could totally crap out and don't give you any better information than WGWA, but they did by a long shot. And here's just in words, it's sort of orders of magnitude. And the upshot from that analysis, I would say, is that the task force work underestimates impact quite generally of experiments.
So can I actually make a comment?
Yeah.
So you assume finite linear binning in A, right?
Right.
So there are many dark energy models that many people like that have an early dark energy component, and that wouldn't be captured in that kind of.
So that's a great question. So give me a chance to make an important point. So the spirit of this particular work is to hand control to the experiments. So we're asking the experiments, what do you measure best? And what we found was to do that, and there's a whole, along with this paper, there's stuff posted on the web, and I can direct you to it easily if you want. And basically, one of the things we do is we try different binnings. So we try the log A and Z, linear and Z, log Z. And you can see already why this is the best, because these points are distributed smoothly on the shape of the modes. And so you can tell it, if I instead bin and Z or something, they'd be all clustered down here, and you wouldn't get very many points trying to depict these truly existing shapes in the modes. And so when you look at, and I don't want to try to find them in a second, but when you go and look at these different ones, you can tell you've chosen the wrong binning. And so what that translates into is that the experiments that we modeled are having trouble delivering the thing you might want to see for those.
But I'm not really convinced about that, but I mean, one problem could be that if you're looking at W, but what if you look at rho dark energy as a function of Z? And right. That would be a constant for lambda. Wouldn't you get a different answer?
Well, there's people who have looked at that, and yeah. I haven't found that very revealing. So we could talk a little bit about why.
Because there are, for example, very strict constraints on rho dark energy at early times. And I'm not sure if that translates for interesting constraints on W, but.
I've found that, I mean, I think basically W is a much more, I think the problem is that I think W is a better thing because that's the most, it's very exciting to know whether you're a cosmological constant or not. And W is the language that helps you do that most directly. And so I feel that the work I've seen where people tried to work with rho, you wind up saying, gee, I don't really know. You know, it's maybe constant, maybe not. In some nebulous space with some uncertainties on that. Whereas any signal, you measure any statistically significant signal in this parameterization, and you know it's not a lambda. So that's the part I like. I'm open, you know, maybe we can look at particular models and see another way to analyze the experiment for that. And I'm open to that. But I'm clinging to this basically because I think it helps me work over here most effectively in the phenomenology. It's one of the things that happens when you when you look at this is that if you look at as you move from the stage to stage, in the task force parameterization, going from stage 3 to stage 4 looked a little bit disappointing, I would say. And then going to these higher order parameters helps you really reveal what you can do. Basically, the essence of the difference is that you're measuring more parameters, and these bars are higher because you're looking at volumes in a higher dimensional space. There's nothing very subtle about that. We even work out a rescaling to show that relationship, which I don't have time to get to now. And in terms of ranking and learning the lessons of combining data sets and all the results of the test course are actually reproduced just with this rescaling that shows the full strength of what you can do. And so one interesting thing is that it inverts the cost. So for increase in impact, it looked like stage 3 was the best deal we did in 2 parameters. And now stage 4 is by far an amazing deal. When you get a better look at what you can actually measure. And plus, I just think these are interesting ways of gaining insight. You can look at these plots and tease out a lot of interesting details of what the experiment is doing. So I've asked this question, and the answer is only what we might have missed by using some of these simple parameters. We possibly missed a possibly very important rescaling, but other than that, a lot of the concrete results are the same. What impact do we have on specific Rick energy models? What's my How much time is left?
I think 15 minutes.
15 minutes left. So I'm going to do this one very quickly. We chose a bunch of scalar field models. If you want to tell me, why would we crappy scalar field models? Sure, we need something deeper than that. I agree. But in the business of advocacy for these things, if there's models out there and you're advocating for this experiment, there's going to be people who say, why didn't you? You mean you're just doing abstract parameters and you haven't even checked what this experiment can do for existing published models as crappy as they are? And I think I didn't want to be in that position. I want to be able to answer that question, even though I'll agree. I think anyone in this room can write down criticisms about simple scalar field models that I would agree with wholeheartedly, and which would be pushing me to try to live out in this space when I think about actually understanding these things. But I think we've chosen models that have stronger than average motivations and interests for what that's worth. And they have very different, also we've chosen models that have very different behaviors. So here's W as a function of A, one of them oscillates, a couple of them go up, one of them comes down. So we're kind of covering territory. And what we found was basically constraints in the parameter space. There's actually a lot of work going into finding the degeneracies and getting to know these models and seeing how this stuff would really work. My students really did a fine job of tackling that. And the upshot is you see successive constraints. You know, they did MCMC calculations, and it's non-quite shapes. And at the end of the day, what we found was a hierarchy of constraints coming from stage two, stage two, stage four, that looked very much the same as the task force hierarchy when expressed in the model space of these scalar field models. And so the upshot is that we found a very similar result to what we learned from the material review, which was exactly the spirit, by the way. It's not that we thought on the task force, wow, there's something very deep about W0WA, but we thought if we throw a couple parameters at this problem, that's probably not going to be that different than throwing another couple parameters at the problem. And that's what panned out in these models. To what extent can these data sets deliver discriminating power between scalar field models? And this gets kind of fun. And it's a paper with a bunch of my students. Michael Bernard is the first author and really energetically took the lead and did some interesting things with this. He's a former student now, he's at Johns Hopkins now. The problem, so one problem we had to address is each scalar field is defined in its own model space with its own parameters. So how do you quantify, how do you sort of discuss them in the common space? And our answer was, map ourselves into these eigenmodes for a given experiment. So the eigenmodes give a complete basis to WA space. We map ourselves into that space and make the comparison in the space among correlated observables. So, and this is just reminding you, we've talked about these independently observed combinations of W mins. That's the language we chose. And the spirit of this is just a created in PowerPoint. There's no meaning to these values, but the spirit is if you can plot your data, if you can plot uncorrelated data and put theory one and theory two on the same plot, there's value in it being the uncorrelated data points, so you can really look at the comparison, and that's what we're doing here, is choosing in the W of A space the uncorrelated data points you can expect from a given experiment, and comparing the theories, different theories with their own different parameters in that space. Okay, so we have a starting point. We start with basically imagining where we might be at the end of the stage two. We have some distribution. Then we plot it in the modes of the higher, the better data sets. And so one remarkable thing about this is that this is these distributions. So each color is a different scalar field model. And each scalar field model, I mean, you might think that in some parameterization, if you let the parameters of a scalar field model run free, they fill up any parameter space you would want for WA. But that's simply not the case. Different, what we learned is that different scalar field models have limits to the different ways W can vary based on their properties. And those limits, to our great good fortune, those constraints to possible behaviors show up even in the handful of the best measured modes, which is another thing. You could say, well, there could be limitations, but it could show up at the higher modes only. But in fact, these limitations have shown up already at mode one and mode two. So this is a very interesting feature, that the models really separate themselves out in the space of observables for dark energy experiments. So I think that's quite interesting. Here's going up to the next two modes. You still see interesting behaviors. These models are hopelessly similar, and we knew that from the beginning. We chose them for theoretical reasons rather than that they're different in some profound way. The modes, I'll remind you, are different for different experiments. This is a picture to show that. And the sigmas change too, so you've got to factor that in when you analyze these things. But I'm just going to show you some of these pictures. Here's to remind you of these models and behaviors. And the interesting point that comes from this is that what this means is that if you get an experiment that's centered here, you have the potential, if you have enough constraining power, if your uncertainties are narrow enough, to totally rule out these other scalar field models. And of course, if you're centered up here, which could happen, then you rule out all these models totally. So it's really revealing a tremendous amount of constraining power in terms of the scalar field. And so then you can look and see, well, how are we doing in terms of units? And we see that the first two modes give pretty interesting discriminating power in units of errors. Second mode, well, stage three, not so clear. Stage four, quite a bit of separation, maybe even something going on in the third mode. And I'm not going to dwell on that. We don't have much time left. In the paper, we quantified all this in a very concrete way and plotted things and tables. And I can tell you all about that. But the upshot is that these principal components, I think, offer a really great way of comparing models with different intrinsic parameters. And the task force stage four data is approaching the threshold of really resolving the structure. Although you basically based on this picture, although you probably want to stretch a little further and in order to do a really excellent job at resolving that sort of structure. Last question about this new working group. This is a working group that was popped into existence over the summer and is pretty much finished. Our report isn't quite out yet, but it's finished. It was really just the agencies, and this was a unified effort with Europe as well as the US, wanted to know, well, what's happened to these discussions of figures of merit and so on since the task force. They wanted an update, so this little working group was formed. And basically, we have decided to work with these eigenmodes in order to more fully explore the capabilities of an experiment. And we've also talked about, I think it's very important to talk about deviations from Einstein gravity, and we've talked about quantifying that, which I've not talked about in my talk, but that's also very important. But I'm just going to, I just have a couple minutes left. You know, if you want to talk about the politics of all this and the nature of our recommendations and all that, well, we can talk about that informally anytime you want. I learned something. The fun thing about being on these panels is you learn something. You learn some science. That's when it's really fun. And I learned something kind of interesting. We all did, I think. So on a panel where people who, I think most of the people who worked intensely with these bin W's and eigenmodes, and we realized something interesting, which is, so remember I was advocating these modes as a complete basis in which to interpret functions W and Z. It turns out there's a preferred normalization in the following sense. So we define this normalization where the bin size comes in. And what we get from that, the reason to do that, is that it becomes grid independent. The shape that we plot out these modes, it doesn't matter what your gridding is, they have the same height. And what that allows you to do, if you look at these sigmas, then you can think very directly about what is a valuable sigma. And you know, if you have prior ideas about how, I mean, most of us don't really think we're interested in W by more than unity in any direction. And so we can impose those priors in a more intuitive way in this language, where the functions F, the modes, have a concrete height that's grid independent. This is something that did. Most of the early work I reported artfully avoided this problem by looking at ratios and other devices. But this sort of led us to think a little more carefully about this. And so the upshot, everyone okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The upshot is that if you think of sort of errors of order unity being your threshold of interest, and you carefully normalize these things, you actually look at, there's actually a whole lot of modes that have their errors below unity. And so the fact that I was showing you plots with larger errors was that I wasn't so careful about factors of grid dependence in there. And so I just say, so a lot of these modes look important. And the upshot is that there's more interesting, well-measured modes than most of us have thought about. And that's kind of fun to think of. How much do we really care about these higher modes? Is gauging sigmas of order one really the right way to do it? But we thought, just having thought a little bit more about it, basically the point is these future experiments will tell us a whole lot. They'll tell us a whole lot of interesting detail. And I think there's even greater opportunities there than I thought originally. And so those of us who want to think about these modes a little bit more I can tell you a little bit more about this. You know, pay attention to the normalization, pay attention to the actual what's going on at the higher modes, because it could be pretty interesting. So I'm going to review. So these are my summary conclusions. We asked this question and found that, yeah, the parameters were kind of feeble in exploring the full range of power that these experiments could have, but the sort of technical results of comparisons and cross the value of mixing different methods all came through fine. And I actually suspect that if you're just ranking different experiments, the W0, W8 tells you everything you get from the same-series analysis, except for how much better a given experiment is. We asked what is the impact on specific dark energy models, and it's very similar to what you see in W0, W8 space. We asked to what extent can these data sets deliver discriminating power between specific dark energy models and stage three, it looked rather poor. There's this interesting threshold in stage four where you're really starting to evolve to pin down structure in this larger space. And so it's, but it's an interesting structure if you think you care enough about scalar fuel models. And then finally, we've done some updated work on this panel, and the lesson is, people are getting used to thinking about these eigenmodes. When some of us were writing early papers on this, it made people nervous, and they were much more comfortable just thinking about two parameters. I think basically people are getting used to thinking about more parameters, and we're learning, in fact, that there's a lot of pretty high frequency modes that are going to be measured and could be possibly quite important to our understanding of dark energy. Thanks.
I mean, so that's about some time.